Okay, we are in Romans chapter 1, and we have been looking at the paragraph that starts in verse 18, which I've cautioned you already a couple of times, and probably need to remind you on a regular basis not to let the reality of the negative things that Paul is going to be saying in our studies as we study in Romans, not to let this overwhelm you, because what he is saying in Romans chapter 1 and following is a description of unregenerate fallen mankind. It's all extraordinarily true, and we live in the midst of it, but it does not apply to us. We are not the lost, unregenerate world. We are the children of God. And though we have to deal with the issues that are here, we do not deal with them under the same condemnation that the world is under. And when we talk of the wrath of God being revealed from heaven, there are implications for believers in this world, because we're not exempt from the cause and effect universe that we live in, nor are we free to just be careless in the way we live, because we will reap what we've sown. But the reaping that a believer reaps, even if it's highly negative, is always child training. It is never condemnation, and there's an enormous difference. So just let me prejudice our thinking in that light as we go into these things, because the picture that Paul paints in Romans chapter 1, particularly in verses 18 through 32, is extremely negative, and we'll be here for a long time. So you'll just have to find a balance. Last week we said that the reason for the revelation of God's wrath, according to verse 18, was man's deliberate attempts to prevent the truth from running in a free course to have its beneficial impact upon all who have the capacity to learn. The translation suppressing the truth in unrighteousness basically boils down to man's attempt to block the free course of truth from running into benefit in the lives of individuals. And the methodology is unrighteousness. The men, by acts of unrighteousness, block the truth from being able to be believed in the lives of many people as they see the reality of the unrighteousness, and they do not see the corresponding reality of the truth. So it's a highly prejudicial situation, and that's how the truth is suppressed or blocked or twisted from its intended course, as men behave or misbehave, I should say, the way they do. And God is responding to that on a daily basis. The wrath of God is constantly being revealed from heaven, and the reason is because men are deliberate in their attempts to prevent the truth from running in its course. Man's animosity toward God, which is very real. Romans chapter 8 says point blankly that the mindset on the flesh is hostile toward God. Man's animosity toward God bleeds out into animosity toward his fellow man, and the two combine to undercut the beneficial impact of the truth. That's why it's ungodliness and unrighteousness. Man's animosity toward God produces animosity horizontally toward his fellow man in ungodliness and unrighteousness. So this antagonizes God, partly because, or mostly because, he's so committed to life, and it antagonizes him greatly for men not only to be committed to death, but to be committed to killing one another. And in his antagonism, he has responded by visiting retribution upon man day after day, night after night, year after year. There are hundreds and thousands and millions of things that happen to people every day that are nothing more than retribution for the choices and attitudes that they've taken. God's active in his response toward man and his ungodliness and his unrighteousness. He's not always obvious about it, but he's active. And this is Paul's opening statement in verse 18 as he attempts to build a case for man's understanding of just how desperately he needs to be saved. If you'll remember, verse 16 establishes Paul's confidence that the gospel is the power of God to salvation, because in it, verse 17, the righteousness of God is revealed to be by faith. But man is not going to come to the righteousness of God by faith if he doesn't see a need for it. And so in verse 18, the need is beginning to be developed. And the need is basically the justice of God. It's called wrath because it's negative, but it's basic retribution. And Paul is going to develop his case so that nobody can study verses 18 down through chapter 3 about verse 20 or so without coming away from it feeling like he's just been unloaded on. And that's deliberate. there has to be a desperation developed in the heart of man before he will ever turn to God to be saved. The sense of desperation is not always obvious, but it's going to have to develop. Nobody ever comes to Christ without first sensing a need to escape the consequences of his own deeds. So Paul in these verses is setting about to establish that need. This evening what we're going to do is look at the first things that man falls back on whenever he's confronted with the inescapable reality of his own failure. Typically man starts looking for an excuse. This is old stuff, Genesis 3. It was that woman that you gave me. It's your fault. But the woman says, oh, it was the snake, you know. This whole business of trying to find some way to minimize or mitigate the awful impact of what is due as children. It starts out, you know, they are throwing the ball in the house and they knock the lamp over and it breaks. And so you say, what happened? Oh, the lamp fell. It's never, I knocked the lamp over. It's never, oh, I was disobeying and I threw the ball. That's never it. It's always some other innocuous way of explaining it away so I'm not responsible. Or at least my responsibility is mitigated by other things. Man is an inveterate seeker of a way to minimize the retribution that's due him. In fact, I noticed on the web this week that there is a hot debate starting to stir right now as to whether people ought to be executed for capital crimes if they committed them before they reached their 18th birthday. And when I read that, I thought, what does being 18 years old have to do with anything? Does turning 18 suddenly bring sense into the heads of human beings? It didn't when I turned 18. I don't see it a lot of times. This whole assumption that people ought not to be held accountable for things they did before they were 18 rests fundamentally on one assumption, and that is if men really knew what they were about to bring on themselves by their actions, they wouldn't do what they're contemplating. But that's not really true. That's why Paul says what he says in verse 8 and 19 and 20. It's this target of trying to mitigate man's responsibility for his behavior. I noticed on the news the other night they were showing a thing where some knothead in Iraq loaded up a tanker truck with explosives and then drove it as close as they could get it to some buildings that he wanted to blow up and blew it up. Well, he killed a whole bunch of people. And the next thing you see is all these people out in the street blaming the United States for this. You know who is responsible for that? The knothead that did it. Okay? Responsibility is always on the shoulders of the person who does it. And yet we want to always give an excuse and start looking for some other parameter so we can blame something else. And this is, you know, hook, line, and sinker. This is humanity. Oh, he's not responsible because of this and this and this. If he did it, he's responsible for having done it. That's the bottom line. And age isn't going to make any difference. And you see the rigidity of that in God's creation. If a tiny baby doesn't know any better and steps off of a 20-foot story roof, gravity will kill that baby just as fast as it'll kill a 70 or 80-year-old man. The whole issue is, if you did it, you're responsible for having done it. Now, obviously, there are mitigating things within Scripture, because even Jesus taught that the one who did not know receives less stripes than the one who's bowed his neck in knowledge. But Paul is going to address this whole business of knowledge in verse 19 and 20. So that's what we're going to look at this evening. His claim, Paul's claim, is that ignorance is not the problem. Now, he has already set forth in verse 18 the claim that God regularly responds to man's evil with retribution. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven. The wrath is the retribution issue. His claim is that a great deal of the negative experience of man is rooted in divine retribution for the deeds that the man has done. Man acts unjustly, God responds justly. His claim is that God is determined to respond in this manner because of man's intentional obstruction of the truth. That's what verse 18 is saying. Now, in verses 19 and 20, Paul sets forth the claim that the problem is not ignorance, Man is not ignorant. God has made, according to verse 19, that which is known about God is evident within their midst because God made it evident to them. So God has made certain facts regarding man's relationship to God. He has made certain things inescapably manifest. And men can be, they can turn from the manifestation, and if they do, like verse 28, if they do not see fit to acknowledge God, God will give them over to depraved mind. But, you know, it's a God again responding to man's hostility in retribution. So when we say in verse 19 that God made something evident, well, then if God made it evident, it's evident. That means it's easy to see. So let's think about this. It says that which is known about God, but then immediately in verse 20, he goes into this invisible attributes. In other words, that which may be known has two parts. And so let's look at what the two parts are in verse 20 as we work around verses 19 and 20 of this evening. There exists, according to verse 19, a thing that can be known about the God. Now, Paul used the definite article in verse 19 because he is a monotheist in a polytheistic culture, and he wants his readers to understand that there are not many gods, there is one God. And this one God has made certain things known that are inescapably true, and no man is ignorant of them, so that he can actually say in verse 20 at the end, so that they have no rational basis for their behavior. Okay, the known thing exists, but what is the known thing? Well, he explains in verse 20, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. So there are two things that are under the known thing. One of them is his eternal power, and the other is his divine nature. What are those things? Well, let's think our way through this carefully because the words need understanding. The known thing consists of two facts. The first one has to do with the reality that God is in relation to this business of an unproduced power producer. Now, what I mean by that is, and I've told you this a little bit before, but just by way of review, the New Testament word theos, which is the word for God, is the Old Testament equivalent to Elohim, which is the generic term in the Old Testament for God. If you want to talk about specific characteristics, then he has other names, other titles, and other descriptive terms. But the Elohim in the Old Testament was the exerciser of power. He is introduced that way in Genesis 1 and 2. He speaks in enormous consequences occur because he is so powerful. And that's the way he's identified. He's the exerciser of power. Well, God, as the exerciser of power, the term means the exerciser of power, is the unproduced power producer. Now, what I mean by that is simply power is such a fundamental issue of experience that nobody disputes its reality. There's not a single cotton-picking thing you can think of or do or say that is disconnected from the exercise and the expenditure of power. You take energy out of the mix and you've got nothing. In fact, science has taught us that if you take the basic components of material and bust it up into its stuff, it's power. It's immaterial power. They split the atom and the explosion is enormous. And they decided that matter is made out of nothing except power. So we have this reality that nobody can live and breathe without recognizing that even inhaling, their chest has to do some things, or at least their stomach, one or the other, has to get out of the way so the lungs can expand and suck air in. Well, that's an exercise of power. And you can't exhale without exercising it. And if the power of your heart stops, you're dead. So everybody knows this. Power is such a fundamental issue in experience that nobody disputes its reality. Now, second thing I want to say about that is power is also such a fundamental issue of the reality that nobody disputes that it takes on a fundamental characteristic that I call absolute permanence. In other words, power is and has been forever. Even evolutionists who want us to go back to the Big Bang, where the big demonstration of power was, are going to ultimately be forced to acknowledge that something is eternal. If you say, where did the stuff come from that blew up? All you're doing is pushing them back to, in a final materialistic sense, they'll say, well, matter's eternal. But since we've already proven the essence of matter's power, then you got back to power is eternal. Which means that whether you're a believer or an unbeliever, the fundamental issue of the reality of power is that power itself is absolutely permanent. It is and has been forever. And according to verse 20, this is clearly seen by creation. The most powerful demonstration of power that men have ever perceived is creation itself. We are absolutely stunned when we send a telescope up out of our atmosphere and it sends us pictures back of things we never even knew were there. We're stunned by the vastness of the creation. And if God spoke this into existence, then obviously the creation itself argues that the power was enormous, beyond description. So, when it says that his invisible attributes, that is, his eternal power, the power that is permanent, in it's absolutely permanent, it's eternal power, that is not a debatable issue by any thinking individual. Now, anything's debatable. Understand me when I say this. People will argue about anything. But that doesn't mean their argument has any weight. God doesn't have a lot of patience with people who will argue about anything. In the day when He calls them up to answer for the attitudes they've taken, their mouths are going to come to a stopped position. And He is not going to listen to it, and they're not going to utter it. And part of the reason is because that which is manifest now is going to be so much more manifest then that there's simply not going to be any argument. So power is a fundamental issue of experience. It's a fundamental reality. It takes on this fundamental characteristic of being eternal. Power has been and is forever. Now that brings up the next issue that is clearly seen, and that is God's divine nature. Is power impersonal force? You know, you can't even talk about power being impersonal force. I just did. But you really can't. You know, in the Star Wars thing, they said, may the force be with you. Well, when they say that, they're actually personifying force. It can't be with you unless it has some personal characteristics. So, even the talk belies us. We're going to be held accountable for every idle word that we speak as unbelievers. And when we speak like that, we are admitting more than we ever want to admit. Because we're admitting we know. We are admitting we know. So, this issue of God's divine nature. I want to talk a little bit about that word that's translated divine nature. Because Paul says the known thing consists of two facts. Number one, God is the unproduced power producer. And number two, God as the unproduced power producer is personal and not impersonal. Now, how do you get there? Well, the word that's translated divine nature is a hard word to translate in a biblical way because this is the only place in the Bible it's used. So he pulled a word out of his cultural setting, never used it before, never used it again. None of the rest of the New Testament writers wanted to use it. It's the word theos, and it's connected in some ways to theos, but Paul used this word here, and nobody else used it at all. And in the world of Paul, this word was used in some enlightening ways. For example, it was used to describe an uncle. How about that? A form of it was used to refer to Caesar. Caesar's my uncle? Well, there's a connection somehow. Yeah, a form of it was used to refer to the gods. That is the polytheism of Rome, the gods. As more than mere men, supermen, or at least beyond humanity. The sense of the word that is translated divine nature, and that's just an attempt by the translators to give you a sense of the word. The sense of the word is that there is someone outside of man's immediate context who controls the social order of man's context. In other words, the uncle is outside the immediate family thing, but he's a part of the oversight of the development of the nephew or niece from the outside. And it has to do with social order stuff. That's why he's the uncle. Caesar was called this because he, in a final sense, was the absolute authority of the Roman Empire, and everything came down from his seat as in terms of authority, and you will do this and you will not do that. And that was fundamentally the issue in government. The gods, you always took your sacrifices to gods to try to appease them or, you know, persuade them to do something that you want, but basically what you're asking them to do is to exercise their power on your behalf. So it comes down to the exercise of power in relation to you and in relation to God, since verse 18 tells us pointedly that his antagonism is against ungodliness and unrighteousness. What he's talking about there is his antagonism toward men who attack the social order with ungodly and unrighteous behavior. They're trying to tear down the fabric of human relationships by their behavior. Now, since he used that term, and it's, like I said, it's a difficult term in some respects, but the conclusion that Paul is addressing is that all men everywhere know that the power that is everlasting is socially constructive, and that means it takes man's relations with his fellow intelligent human beings into consideration and lays down laws to reward and penalize men's actions toward those fellow intelligent beings, and that can't be anything but personal. You can't lay down law as an impersonal force. Only a person can do that. You can't take anything into consideration if you don't have a considerer. I put too many ERs on the end of that word. If you don't have a mind, you can't consider. So from the very outworking of creation and God's insistence from the creation of the world that you will do this and you will not do that, or this will be the penalty, we have this exerciser of power who is very much into making sure that the exercise of power by those that he's sharing this ability with will be constructive and not destructive. And if it's destructive, he will take and destroy them so that he can eliminate them from the whole process of his kingdom plan so that they cannot destroy the final order. And that's why before you even have the establishment of the final kingdom, you have this great white throne judgment where God just gets rid of all of the destructive elements, all of those destructive persons who refused to be constructive in their exercise of the power that God had imparted to them. Paul says this is clearly manifest from the creation of the world. Nobody can rationally argue that the power is not eternal and that it's impersonal. It won't work. Power everywhere is personal. It comes right out of the exercise of personal choice. Because impersonality can't take into consideration, it can't lay down laws. You have to have uncles and Caesars and the gods. They're all extensions of personhood. And that's why divine nature actually boils down to personal identity. There are two things about God that Paul says are inescapably true, and every man knows them because he's made it evident to them, and that is, number one, he's powerful. Number two, he's personal. You're going to have to deal with him. And that's the reason why most men live in terror all their lifetime, fear of death, because there is this innate, made manifest knowledge that they have an appointment with a personal judge who is more powerful than they are. This known thing, Paul says in verse 19, is inescapable. It says that God has made it known within them. Well, this is more than just in their heart. He has made it known within them because, according to chapter 2, they by nature do the things written in the law of God, which shows that the law was written in their hearts. So it's within them, but it's also within their midst. Which means that as they live and breathe, they're sucking in and exhaling out the reality that God has made manifest. This manifest truth surrounds man. It is in his midst. And it is so because, according to verse 19, God made it manifest to them. Men can claim to be too intelligent to buy all of this Bible stuff if they want to, but all that ends up doing is being verse 22. Professing to be wise, they become fools. God has no patience with that kind of stuff. The truth is, if you push people in their discussions about why they're not going to consider God and His claims on their life, finally, if they're honest, they'll say, I don't want Him ruling over me. I do not want there to be a God to whom I'm liable because I know I don't want Him bossing me around. And you can't say that to God without being liable. So, the known thing is inescapable. It's a horrible reality that men can know this and it not faze them. But that's Paul's point. If you'll look over to verse 32, it says, although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but they give hearty approval to those who practice them. Now, is ignorance the problem? No. That's Paul's point. So when we try to mitigate responsibility by saying, it was ignorance, I didn't know, Paul says, that's not the problem. Ignorance is not the problem. The known thing is known. God made it known. And there isn't any escape from the knowledge. Because God won't let you escape from the knowledge. It's inescapable. It's easily discerned because it's manifest. And it's manifest by the indisputable power behind the universe that makes it inescapable. The next thing that I want to make a note of is the admission in verse 20 that Paul makes about the fact that God is invisible. These are invisible attributes. But though he admits that they're invisible, he says they're clearly seen in the middle of the verse. Now, obviously, he's using figure speech because you can't see invisible things. But we do that all the time. We say, oh, I see that. And we're not talking about our eyes at all. What are we talking about? We're talking about our mental processes. We're talking about our understanding. And that's what he's talking about, being understood through the things that have been made. So that when he says the ultimate realities are invisible, and quite frankly, neither power nor personhood are visible commodities. You can't see power, you can't see personhood. All you can see are the effects of the causes. You can see power demonstrated, you can see personhood made manifest by activity or whatever, but neither one of those things are visible commodities. There is a definitive link between that which is the invisible and yet real and man's ability to see it. And the definitive link is his rationality. Man is able to reason. What does that mean? Well, it means that he has the ability to link truths to each other and to the truth as a whole. Man's rationality is his ability to take this piece of data and link it to this piece of data so that now he can use these two pieces and link them to these over here and actually guide the exercise of power in his own life. That's his rationality. This is the way men see. It has almost nothing to do with their eyes. Now, a little. We are said to have five senses. Okay? Most of them are in our head. Eyes, smell, taste, hearing. What's the last one? Touch. All right, that's the only one that's not directly right here in your head. And I think that's instructive. And everybody knows that you can take somebody who's lost one of those senses, or even two of them, or maybe even three of them, and they can still achieve a high level of performance in this world in the exercise of power. We have been given five, but we don't have to have five to be able to function. And the reason is because we're reasonable. We're rational. We can think. We can compensate from the loss of this because of our minds. So, God has made the invisible so visible that man cannot escape it. And that clearly means that man's problem is not that he doesn't know. That's Paul's opening salvo, verses 19 and 20. It is not because man does not know. One of the reasons that the wrath of God is revealed from heaven is because men do what they do to the truth deliberately. It is not ignorant. There is a diati that is translated because in verse 19, and it comes out again in verse... It's not used a lot, but it starts verse 21 also. It's translated for there. But the uniqueness of that word tells us what Paul's argument is, and he's got two big arguments. Verse 18 says the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against men because of their antagonism toward the truth and the way they deal with it. Because, in verse 19, they know better. And then, because, in verse 21, they refused to honor God as God. They knew Him, but they would not honor Him as God. So, what we're saying here is that man cannot plead ignorance, neither of power, nor of its constructive, socially constructive nature. Man cannot say, I didn't know there was power. He cannot say that the power was supposed to be used constructively toward others. He can't say either one of those things. He knows better than that. God has made it manifest. He can't plead ignorance. And that means that his socially destructive behavior, i.e. ungodliness and unrighteousness in verse 18, has to be rooted in something other than ignorance. It's not rooted in ignorance. So God's intentional retribution, as laid out in verse 18, is going to address this issue of man according to his real problem, which is not ignorance. And therefore, retribution has a purpose that is not fundamentally to inform man of something he didn't know. Retribution is not a new idea to man. It is so built in that when something goes wrong, even the most backwards in terms of education, the individual will say something like, "What did I do to deserve this?" That is so built into our psyche. We know that retribution is a reality. So, what we have to ask is, why is God manifesting constantly His wrath from heaven against men who know better than to do what they're doing? They're not ignorant. Why is He doing it if it's not an ignorance issue? Well, there are two reasons. It is designed, retribution is designed by God, on the one hand, to curb the destruction introduced by man. It is true that if a person has to pay a price for what he does, many times the very fact that he will have to pay the price will deter him from doing what he's thinking about doing. People who argue that retribution is not a deterrent don't know what they're talking about. Now, it's not always a deterrent. But there are multiple cases in everybody's experience where they would like to do something but the price is higher than they want to pay. And so they don't do it. And it's not that they don't want to do it. They're deterred by the consequences. And so God imposes retribution in order to deter. That minimizes and curbs the level of destruction that is introduced by man, and that's the reason why it's taking is the time that it's taking for the mystery of iniquity to finally build up to the point where man's lack of deterrence is almost maximized. He doesn't care anymore. There's no fear of God before his eyes, and he's magnified himself into a god. It's going to take, it's already taken 6,000 years to build. And part of the reason is because the wrath of God has constantly been being revealed. Even the dispersal at Babel, which was designed by God to slow the process of evil down, was a manifestation of the wrath of God. But it did what it was intended to do. It slowed the process down. It put the brakes on the socially destructive behavior that men introduce in their environment. It's designed for that. That's one of the reasons why God is retributive. Secondly, retribution is designed by God to push men toward terror. The reason why God's retribution is as severe as it is because for many people, only great severity will cause them to stop and think and consider whether they need to be delivered from what it is that's destroying them, which is themselves. I have met the enemy, and he is me. Well, God imposes retribution on men so that in the face of the awesomeness of the consequences of my actions, I will be driven to the terror of my consequences so that perhaps I will seek God. That's part of the intention of retribution. Men often are so stiff-necked in their rebellious ungodliness and unrighteousness that they simply will not stop unless God slaps them down to the ground with his retribution. Then, they may actually stop and think, you know, I'm not only destroying myself, I'm going to be destroyed. I need somebody to deliver me. And so it's a prelude to evangelism. That's the one reason why the law was given before grace and truth came. Because men have to have a sense of desperation in order to seek salvation from a God they consider to be hostile. You see, their attitude toward God's hostility. They assume his attitude toward them is hostility, and the assumption's partly right. The thing they don't understand is that his hostility toward them can be changed. There can be reconciliation. But only if they want to be reconciled. And that's where retribution steps in the picture. It makes you want to be reconciled. So, when Paul says in verse 18 that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven because men are deliberate in their suppression of the truth, he goes on in verses 19 and 20 and tells us it's deliberate. It is not because they don't know. They do know. They're doing it anyway. So that raises this huge thing about what is wrong with man that he cannot be educated out of his wickedness. He cannot. You cannot educate people out of their evil. They have to be brought out by something that is not fundamentally educational in the sense of, you can't just teach people out of their evil. Men do evil because they are evil. If they're going to ever do good, it's going to be because God's going to make them good. And that's not an educational process. That's a birthing process. Now, granted, there's some educational stuff involved because obviously if the gospel contains a revelation of the righteousness of God, then education's in the mix. It's a revelation. You learn from it. And if the wrath of God is being revealed, you learn from that. But learning is not the key because ignorance is not the problem. The problem is rebellion. The only time education helps when a person's caught up in rebellion is if he's looking for a way out. And generally, retribution's the reason why he wants out. Nobody ever wants out of a cushy situation. We do not respond with neediness. As long as there are no needs. That's why I said several weeks ago that self-indulgence is a lousy seedbed for the proclamation of the gospel. We do people enormous damage if we give them the impression that God's whole purpose here is to indulge them. If we have been so self-indulgent in our own behavior, people can't hear the gospel because they're only seeing this lousy seedbed. Because people do not respond if they don't have a need. And need only comes at crunch time. So retribution is designed to create this sense of need. And we'll get into some more of this, but I want you to understand tonight that Paul's perspective on man is not that he's ignorant. He's not ignorant. That's not the issue. And Paul wants us to understand that it's not been the issue from the creation of the world. He does plead a little special case of deception on the east part in 1 Timothy 2. But he says Adam was not deceived. Was not ignorance on his part. Okay, questions or comments? Told you it was going to be kind of negative.
When at the end of Matthew, when we get this command to go into the world teach, make disciples.
Right, make mm-hmm. disciples. That's the call for us to do.
Mm-hmm.
And always, someone would always ask me, what about those who have not heard?
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard people go to this verse.
Mm-hmm. Well, a better verse is Romans 10, because Paul point blankly asks, have they not all heard? And his answer is, indeed they have. There's no such thing as a person who hadn't heard. Now, there is such a thing as a person who hasn't heard the gospel. But
they've heard in the sense that we speak.
Well, they know the power and they know the personality of God. He's made that manifest. And God only can educate people who want to know. And that's why the preaching of the gospel does absolutely no good at all if people don't want to be saved. If they don't want to know, telling them won't help. But the retribution in the context of power and personhood, that retribution can create a desire to know. And then teaching can be effective, but only if you want to know.
That's why when you go visit prisons, I've always found, I would much rather go like to death row,
uh-huh.
where these guys are sitting on death row, and they're in that little box, and they feed them, you know, that high, because they'll talk to you forever.
Yeah.
It's forced them into this box.
Uh-huh.
Then go to a minimum security prison when they don't need it, they don't want to hear it, they're getting to get it with their homeboys next week. So.
Sure. Well, and that's what I meant. As long as there's no need, there's no sense of desperation. You don't need, you're not going to want. Okay? Let's have a word of prayer then, and we'll visit some. Father, we're grateful to you this evening for the amazing mercy that you've shown us, the enormous grace, the long-suffering and patience, the willingness that you have to bring us to joy, and even the fact that your wrath is designed to push us into the corner so that we will turn and discover that you are gracious. We know that after 1,500 years of legal history with the nation of Israel, when you sent Gabriel to Zacharias, you told him to name his son, Yahweh is gracious. And we pray, Father, that you'll keep us on that track even as we're studying these things about your justice. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen.